It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Geek Therapy Radio.
Welcome to Geek Therapy Radio. You've got your mental curator, Johnny Hemberger. For more information and how to contact me instantly, go to geektherapyradio.com. I have a very fascinating show today. You may have heard or seen in the news, it may have come across your internet news feed, about the radical new Flying V airliner design out of TU Delft University in the Netherlands, and I decided to talk to the team to get more information about this fantastical aeronautical development. So without further ado, let's talk to Professor Peter Vink about how he and his team are developing the Flying V commercial airliner. And we begin by talking about the intended service range and possible renewable fuel sources.
Interior, it's important that you know for which type of flight it is. So it's a long distance flight.
So would that mean between New York and London or something?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. That's amazing. I figured it was because of the increased fuel efficiency
that it can. And what I also I'm involved in, there are three tracks to be checked. One is that we keep the current way of propulsion, and then it's only 20% reduction of CO2 and 20% less fuel consumption.
Wow.
But we also study if it's possible to fly with hydrogen.
Wow.
And then it means the no CO2 to there's no CO2 coming out of the air anymore. And the second one is synthetic kerosene, and that's maybe the most promising one because you can use the current infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Synthetic kerosene is made by taking CO2 and water out of the air and then produce a kind of kerosene. It's much more expensive at the moment, so that's the biggest issue.
Right. But with anything, once it's developed, you know, in mass, the price comes down and it will become...
Yeah, let's hope so. Yeah.
So one of the goals...
Well, we'll first have a flight now of Transavia with one engine. The first 1,000 liters are made, one engine synthetic and one engine normal kerosene.
Interesting. And the characteristics of the fuel are the same? Nearly the same?
Yeah, but we tested it on ground, but we don't know how it behaves in the air.
Okay.
Therefore, we need one engine normal.
Right, but that's very fascinating. When did this project begin?
Oh, it began 2016. There was a guy doing an internship, Justus Benno, an internship in Airbus. Mm-hmm. And it was patented. And from that on, TU Delft helped a lot in setting the next steps. So Airbus and TU Delft both developed after that. So it's already 4 years going on.
Wow. And what sponsors do you have thus far?
KLM and Airbus are the most important partners at the moment.
Yeah.
But we have also the sponsoring of our own university.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot in teaching programs. That means students learn, mm-hmm. but at the same time we gain new knowledge.
That's wonderful. Moving on to the aircraft a little bit more here, do you know how fast it cruises, how fast it flies?
That's not decided yet, but because the faster you go, we don't know on which height it will fly also. It depends also on the type of propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not my area of expertise. But I heard from the guys that if you fly too high with hydrogen, you get too much white stripes in the air.
Mm-hmm.
If you fly too low, you don't have the white stripes, but then it's not so fuel efficient anymore. So we didn't decide yet which height it will fly. Naturally. But it will be according to approximately the same as now 0.9 Mach.
Point 0.9 Mach? That's very quick. That's very fast.
0.85, 0.9, yeah.
Right.
It depends on that.
So that's around the same speed as, you know, 747 and major airliners. That's wonderful. And I've read that you don't need to do any modifications to runways or airports or terminals or gates. That's true?
Yeah, because it fits on the normal gates. So it was really made for that. Mm-hmm. And the runway length is also approximately the same. It's a little bit high on his landing gear, mm-hmm. but still it's feasible within. And it's even a little bit smaller than the A350.
Okay.
With the same number of passengers.
It's wonderful that you don't need to do any modifications to runways or to airports. That's going to be a major selling point and ease of access to airports around the world that can accept this aircraft.
One thing that might be an issue because it's high on his landing gear, mm-hmm. and some of the stuff bringing catering in the airplane, it might be. And maybe new material that's a little bit higher.
Okay. Do you know, and we'll move on to the interior and such next, do you know if the airplane will take more length to take off and land or less than a normal airplane?
It's the same is the idea. Mm. We had the first flight this summer of a model. And it behaves quite good. Only the Dutch roll might be an issue, so there has to be some modification. But that's the advantage of doing a test that you learn.
Okay. So moving on to, let's see. I don't see why it would be any safer in a crash, unfortunately, than hopefully it never crashes, you know. But do you know if it's safer or less safe or the exact same for passengers?
I think it's approximately the exact same, but what we still have to do is the evacuation tests. In simulations, it seems rather okay, but we want to do a real test the coming year with half of an airplane because it's a flying V, so the passengers are in the wing, and one wing we would like to make in the hall of our university and then let 170 passengers evacuate. And also boarding and deboarding needs to be tested. Seems that it could be faster than the current one because you have two doors next to each other, so you can have two people going in next to each other. Although with the corona, that's not possible. But then we hope that that's solved in 50 years.
Don't go anywhere. When we come back to Geek Therapy Radio, we're going to talk about the actual interior design of the Flying V and how that can radically ease boarding and deboarding the aircraft. More Geek Therapy Radio coming up. Don't go anywhere. For podcasts, contact, and more, visit geektherapyradio.com. Welcome back to Geek Therapy Radio. You've got your mental curator, Johnny Hemberger. I've been talking to Professor Peter Vink of TU Delft University in the Netherlands. He and his team are designing a radical Flying V commercial aircraft, and they have backing from KLM. There are airlines interested in this radical new design. So we've kind of talked about the design of the plane, the range of the plane, what kind of fuel the plane uses. Now let's talk about the actual interior design of the plane. It is actually very fascinating. If you thought the exterior of the aircraft was radical and cool, just wait until you hear about the actual interior of the airplane. It is an ingenious use of space that will be a godsend to any air traveler. So without further ado, let's continue the conversation with Professor Peter Vink of TU Delft University in the Netherlands.
My friend actually brought that up the other day. He was wondering if there was any way to, if you could board two lines of passengers at the same time, that would help speed up the boarding.
And the interesting thing is that the left row goes to the left of the airplane, the right row goes to the right of the airplane. So that means it's really separated in the airplane itself as well.
Wonderful. So I have the final two or three questions here. And it's having to deal with passenger comfort. Now, I've seen the designs and concepts for the structure of the interior using a skeletal structure to save weight. It's to save weight, which helps increase fuel efficiency. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, because maybe you've seen the interior where which is the direction now. There were 80 ideas of students, mm-hmm. and four were selected. And those four three of those four will probably be implemented in the Flying V. Mm-hmm. And it will be made lightweight, lighter than the current seats. And that's possible because we don't put a recline in there, but instead of that, we put that you can take a different position, so you can sit in the middle, mm-hmm. but halfway the flight you can go to the sleeping boxes or you can go to the lounge seats, or of course from the lounge seats to, so you change your position halfway the flight, or right. maybe you can do it three times, there are some first studies, but of course if you talk to crew, they don't like that, because then they have to tell people, now you have to go out of your bed and mm-hmm. go to the seat. So we have to make systems like in the bed that the sound goes on a little bit, light goes on a bit, mm-hmm. and then you get a voice telling you, in 5 minutes you booked your seat, mm-hmm. so you can you change your position from now, so that the flight attendants are not the police,
yeah.
but more guiding the process, and that the system itself tells the people how to change. So that's right. That's something. So you change your position, mm-hmm. and what we also tested is that your hand luggage is above you, so you stand in a row between the seats, mm-hmm. and then you can still have access to your hand luggage, which is also nice because if you want to have something during the flight, you can pick it up. And you can change your posture there.
It sounds wonderful, and it's also natural that at this stage in the process, you and your team figuring out the logistics of how the passengers will live in the airplane for the flight, you know, switching seats, as you were saying, going from the beds to the seats, to the recliners, to the lounge area. But it sounds like
what's also very interesting, we all thought we have three beds on top of each other. Mm-hmm. We all thought, well, that's going to be heavy, how to arrange that. Mm-hmm. But we did really test it with a wooden mock-up, and even people of 70 years old came in the upper bed, mm-hmm. and in the lowest bed. So sometimes you have to really test things before saying it doesn't work.
Right.
It was interesting.
That's very good. So in the same line of passenger comfort, in normal airplanes with a center fuselage and wings, you know, the wings flex to help absorb turbulence. In a Flying V that seems to be more rigid, how would turbulence be for the passengers in the Flying V?
Yeah, we had some calculation about it, but this is certainly a good question which further needs to be studied. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that the wings are that large, and if you fly in a Boeing 747, you have also a more stable flight than when you fly in a Cessna. Mm-hmm. And so because of the massive construction, we think turbulence won't be that fast, mm-hmm. that heavy. But if there is turbulence, then there's nothing that stops it. So that has to be studied further.
Right. I figured that's where it would be. There'd be much more study going into turbulence, maybe some sort of shock absorbers for the seats or the floor, the structure, and some key points to allow it to flex a little bit to absorb the bumps in the air. So thank you for answering that question. One final question, and I feel like you might be asked this quite often. Motion sickness in a Flying V where the passengers are on the exterior edge of the aircraft, in the aircraft banks to the left or to the right, you know, steers.
Yeah, but the difference is not that large with a A380, okay. because what we did in the in the you have the wing, and you have the wing close to the middle. Mm-hmm. And if you go more to the outside of the wing, in that part we put the cargo and not the people.
Okay.
So the the people are more closest to the center of the airplane, and then there are the sleeping boxes for the flight crew, and then there is the cargo. So right. The idea is it's not so more different than the A380s, and that's because to prevent that you have strange movements in the airplane. Yeah.
Right, sharp movements up or down, yeah. Several yeah, feet. Yeah. Do you
one
think
of the biggest things we have now is that the angle of attack and the angle when taking off is too steep. Mm-hmm. So we have to find solutions for that. That was from the test flight, it was clear.
That's a very interesting point, and I thought that might be, I'm not an aircraft engineer or pretend to be, but I was wondering that if the passengers in the test flights, if the passengers said, okay, we're sitting on the inside of the wing, it's still a little bit too much movement up or down when you are banking in the airplane, you can change the way you fly the airplane so that you don't have to take so many steep yeah. turns, and it's just
yeah.
right training the pilots that maybe you can't bank 15 degrees yeah. or whatever, maybe you keep it limited to 5 degrees, 10 degrees yeah. for passenger comforts as they sit yeah. in the aircraft.
That's interesting because we have Simona, that's a flight simulator, so we're going mm-hmm. to program and train pilots how to fly with this flying V as well.
A final fun question, and again, thank you for your time. Are any of your students playing the new flight simulator that just came out?
Yeah, of course.
I've been playing flight simulators since I was a little boy. I very much enjoy them. So I figured you and your students are probably yeah. having a bit of fun there. It's very very realistic. It looks very good, and a lot of real pilots seem to like it. So that's fun that you and your students are enjoying it as well. There's much more Geek Therapy Radio coming up, and as any veteran listener of Geek Therapy Radio knows, whenever there's mention of the final question, it's never really the final question. It's more like we're nearing the end of the conversation. So there is more of this fascinating conversation to come with Professor Peter Vink of TU Delft University discussing their radical new Flying V commercial airplane design. So there is much more coming up in that discussion. So thank you so much for listening thus far. But we are not done yet. I'm happy I got the opportunity to ask him about Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020. That is a very recent and topical flight simulation video game. I'm kind of counting the days now that I'm mentioning it. I'm kind of counting the days before we have a TU Delft Flying V in Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020. Wouldn't that be cool? More Geek Therapy Radio coming up. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Geek Therapy Radio. You've got your mental curator, Johnny Hemberger, here with you. I am talking to Professor Peter Vink of TU Delft University in the Netherlands. You may have seen their radical commercial airliner Flying V design in the news. They did their first scale model, a successful test flight, and it's going well. They are backed by KLM, so they have airlines interested in this design. Could you imagine the day, one day sometime, perhaps in the relatively near future, looking up and seeing a Flying V-shape airliner flying through the sky? No, it's not a stealth bomber or any military aircraft. In fact, it's more shaped like a boomerang, so it's not a solid triangle. It is literally a Flying V-shape. Obviously, it's not spinning like a boomerang. That would be terrible for passenger comfort. Anyways, let's wrap up the conversation with Professor Peter Vink now regarding the Flying V from TU Delft University. How will the actual seats be arranged?
But also the interior ideas, because in many of there's a traditional interior, which is not possible because then you fly 28 degrees with respect to the flying direction. So we have staggered seats.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
That's right. For extra elbow room and...
Yeah. But not for the room. That's because you have... You cannot fly in the... Because you have the wings and people are in the wings. And if you sit, position the wing people in the wings, they have 28 degrees with respect to the flying direction. And that's not allowed according to security rules. So you have to show pictures where the seats are in the flying direction. And then you have staggered seats. And that has the advantage of the elbow, yes.
Absolutely. When the show airs, I always tell my listeners to download the podcast and go to the website. And that's where I will include links to everything we're talking about so they can read for themselves and see for themselves. And I know my listeners are really, really going to enjoy this. They're very fascinated about this. I didn't know if I told you the name of my show. It's called Geek Therapy Radio because we are all geeks about something. We're all fascinated with different hobbies, different sciences, different technologies. So I have quite a lot of listeners that are aviation geeks.
Okay, so
they're going to love this. And even those who aren't into aviation, they will still find it fascinating, and maybe they will become interested in aviation because of the radical new designs that you and your team are bringing to the world.
Yeah. It's so much fun to work on this. It's really incredible. And it's also, it's not the perfect airplane, and there will be a lot of issues, but we have some time to solve them.
But that's what humans do, and the Dutch especially are so famously curious with exploration and advancing technology. I love following this story. It's so revolutionary. It kind of gives me goosebumps to think about. It's so neat.
Sometimes for me as well. Yeah.
So, Professor, thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you for the good questions, Johnny.
My eternal gratitude to Professor, I should say Dr. Peter Vink, for giving me his time in discussing possibly the most fascinating aeronautical development in recent history. I mean, of course, aside from SpaceX and space flight, there hasn't been any sort of radical change to global aviation, to intercontinental and just even continental aviation in decades. I'm trying to think of the last real revolution in terrestrial aviation. And right off the top of my head, and I don't think anybody would argue this, the Concorde. The Concorde has come and gone. The last flight of the Concorde was, I want to say off the top of my head, and I'll pause it here to confirm this, but I believe it was 2003. Let me just Google this real quick. Yep, it was October 24th, 2003. The last flight was out of John F. Kennedy International Airport to London's Heathrow Airport. And again, that was October 24th, 2003. How can I remember that date of all the things? And this is something that my wife would give me, would rib me about. She said, you can't remember this, but you can remember the year of the last flight of the Concorde. Why can't you remember this day or this specific thing or memorize this quote by so-and-so. I sing in church, for those of you who don't know. And I am still, because it's a blanket, it's a safety blanket, I still look at the lyrics on the sheet. She'll say, so you'll remember really odd, obscure things about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from 1987, or the flight of the last Concorde in October 24th, 2003, but you can't remember a song that we've sung 100 times. You can't memorize it. And it's kind of, to me, it's not an issue of can I or can't I memorize it. I can memorize it. I as a test to myself, not to get too sidetracked here, but we're done with the conversation about the Flying V, so I'll get a little bit sidetracked. I did a test to myself, a challenged myself several years ago in 2008. I wanted to work on my memory and comprehension skills and my public speaking and my bravery being in front of a crowd, because at that time in my life, if you remember, if you listened to past podcasts of Geek Therapy Radio or past radio shows of Geek Therapy Radio, that's about the time in my life I decided I wanted to get into radio. And while getting into radio is not the exact same thing as public speaking, some would say yes, some would say no. I will say there is a dramatic difference between being in an auditorium and talking to 1,500 people whose faces you can see versus talking into a microphone to a conceivable 6 million people. 6 million people obviously aren't listening to my radio show right now at any given moment, but the signal is reaching at least thousands of people. At any given moment, there are probably a few thousand people listening to my voice. But I can't see you! And that's the difference. Many times I record the radio show not wearing... Well, I'll leave it at that. So I did the play as a challenge to myself to speak publicly and be as comfortable as I could be speaking publicly, but also test my memorization skills, because up until that point, I hadn't memorized anything since I had memorized and since forgotten most of the Gettysburg Address, I believe back in fifth grade. And I was a cut up class clown little idiot in fifth grade. And my history teacher, when she called my name to give my speech, everybody in the class had to memorize a different speech. Each speech was a few pages long. It was a considerable thing for a fifth grader to memorize. Every single kid in the class, I went to Willow Creek Elementary School in Kingwood, Texas. Every single kid in my fifth grade class in 1990, whatever, like flubbed their speech, got messed up a paragraph into it, a few sentences into it, just butchered it, butchered their speech if they could remember it at all. I don't know if they got stage fright or what. But since I was a cut-up class clown that my teachers really didn't expect much of, especially my history teacher, she was always punishing me for something or other. When she called my name, she just kind of put her cheek in her palm on her desk and was just waiting for, you know, just had the red pen ready to give the F. And I just banged out the Gettysburg Address. 47 years ago, our forefathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation. I don't remember exactly right now, but back in fifth grade, I remembered it word for word. Punctuation, emphasis on certain words. I delivered the speech as best I could, like Abraham Lincoln. And I remember studying that speech for days with my mom helping me memorize the speech. So when I launched into this speech perfectly, it was one of those, oh, what's that freaking movie? Good Will Hunting? It was like I was the janitor who figured out the math equation, the unsolvable math equation on the chalkboard. The kids were just looking up at me like, what? The teacher was just speechless. I was the child that she had the lowest expectations of, and I got up there and I rocked the Gettysburg Address. So years later, I did the play to re-challenge my memorization skills, not only to challenge myself with getting comfortable with public speaking, but also challenge my memorization. This memorizing a play is not just memorizing, depending on, I guess, how big your part is. It's not just memorizing a few lines. I had to memorize a book. And you also, I'll say this, anybody who's done a play knows what I'm talking about. You are not just memorizing your lines. You are memorizing other people's lines as well. Maybe not to do their role, maybe not as the role of an understudy, but you need to know the timing of what the other characters, the other actors are doing. So me memorizing lines for Romeo, so to speak, and I did play Romeo in this particular play, good night, Juliet, good morning, Desdemona, or good night, Desdemona, good morning, Juliet, something like that. I memorized that whole book. And I had to memorize, by proxy, the other actor's lines. And I say that because, to bring it all back around, why do I remember certain obscure facts about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in The Last Flight of the Conchord, and I can't remember music that I've sung 100 times? It takes effort to memorize things. Anyways, more Geek Therapy Radio coming up. Don't go anywhere. Why'd I get off on this tangent? Welcome back to Geek Therapy Radio. You've got your mental curator, Johnny Hemberger. Go to geektherapyradio.com for podcasts, contact information, and much more. Matter of fact, when you go to geektherapyradio.com, the very, very first thing you see, besides a really cool background of a turntable turning, is the contact form. Before I try to ask you to support me on whatever or buy merch or a mug or Geek Therapy Radio stickers, the only thing you see is a way to contact me and tell me your geek thing and just say whatever you want to me. Just give a shout out. Say, hey man, love your show, or hey man, I hate your show. Whatever. GeekTherapyRadio.com. All right, so I want to stay, at least for now, in the vein of aviation. I was thinking about this during the break. I brought up, I don't know how long ago I brought this up, but speaking of the Concorde and supersonic aviation, some of us might wonder, well, the Concorde came and went, and there's arguments and reasons that people give for why the Concorde went away. It was way too expensive. It was too loud. It polluted too much. Blah, blah, blah. All these factors that contributed to its death. Not just that it suffered its first and only fatal airline crash shortly before its last commercial flight. It wasn't really that people worried about safety. It had to do with cost and pollution and whatever. Although, you know what, I would argue that, I don't want to get too sidetracked here, but anybody who listens to my show knows my stance on pollution when it comes to, because I am the guy who loves solar panels and renewable energy, my stance on pollution when it comes to things like supercars, classic cars, and in aviation's case, the Concorde. So my only beef that I've ever expressed, since it's not a political show, and I try my best to keep this apolitical and be the oasis and be a radio show that's an oasis in a desert of politics, I've mentioned my only beef with the Green New Deal. I mean, there's other beefs too, but the main beef, as a geek, as somebody who loves classic cars and supercars and aviation and all sorts of cool machinery that runs on fossil fuels, is that people often say one of the reasons for Green New Deal and wanting renewable energy and green energy and such, they'll see a Lamborghini, for instance, a V12 naturally aspirated or turbocharged Lamborghini or Ferrari or whatever that doesn't get 45 miles to the gallon, or that isn't electric. A classic, let's say, a Lamborghini Countach, or let's do an old muscle car. Let's do an old, let's stay away from 70s Mustangs, but like a 1965 Mustang. There are some people out there who are pro Green New Deal who think that old muscle cars and V12 supercars, for instance, should go the way of the dinosaurs, should go extinct. Why? They'll say they pollute so much. They're so bad for the environment. My argument has always been that, yeah, let's use that Lamborghini, that V12 Lamborghini, for instance here. That Lamborghini may never in its lifetime, if it's like most hypercars, never see mileage past 20,000 miles or 30,000 miles or, God forbid, 50,000 miles. The point is, you are not going to drive those vehicles. Let's talk about that 1965 Mustang. How often is the owner of that vehicle going to put gasoline through that engine? Once in a blue moon, maybe once every weekend if they're lucky. Those vehicles are not consuming even a fraction of the amount of fuel in its lifetime that a Toyota Prius will, that a hybrid will, even that an EV, purely electric vehicle, will, depending on how it's getting its electricity. In a lot of states, you're charging your Tesla with coal, so you're actually not doing a whole lot of good for the environment. In fact, there are some studies that say that you're doing more damage for the environment powering your car in a coal state. Your electric car in a coal state, you're creating more of a carbon footprint. My point is, What people fail to realize is that that supercar or that old muscle car, you are driving it only a few hundred miles a year versus that hybrid you are driving for 10, 12, 20,000 miles a year if you're a big time commuter. That Prius, that hybrid is going to consume hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil. It is going to burn through thousands of barrels of crude oil versus that old muscle car or that V12 Lamborghini that gets terrible gas mileage. It's still not going to be a drop in the ocean of the amount of fuel that the hybrid will use over its lifetime. So my argument to people saying the Concorde just polluted too much, it wasn't green, it wasn't good for the environment. There were so few Concorde flights in comparison to commercial airliners that proponents saying that the Concorde was just too polluting to be in the environment, it's not green enough, it needs to go, that's one reason why it went, is malarkey. That argument, that idea that it polluted so much that it had to go is just asinine. It did not burn even a drop in the ocean of the amount of fuel that the aviation industry used on the whole because the flights were so rare. Yes, it guzzled fuel like a hungry, hungry hippo. But it did not use, on the whole, compared to the rest of aviation, even a fraction of the amount of fuel. The Concorde aircraft, all the Concorde aircraft combined, didn't use a fraction of the amount of fuel that the entire fleet of 747s and 737s and 777s and 727s and A319s and A320s and 780 and Dreamliners and A380s and whatever, all these jumbo jets and all the private airplanes and piston driven and turbines and turboprops and jets. Concorde fuel use overall, total, didn't even compare. But I'll tell you what was the actual death knell with the Concorde. It wasn't even that it was noisy and it bothered neighbors and it would wake people up. If it was taken off from LaGuardia or John F. Kennedy in New York, you had to turn the afterburners on for it to take off, and it was very loud, and you couldn't go supersonic over land, all that stuff. Yeah, those are viable reasons, but that's not the real reason why the Concorde went down. The real reason, I mean, to break it down to simple nuts and bolts of it, was cost. Was profit. It was just dollars, like everything else in the world. It came down to money. It just wasn't profitable. One of the death knells in supersonic aviation, which even if it were brought back today, and there are, forgive the pun, fly-by-night companies that keep trying to bring back supersonic aviation, I for one would love to see supersonic aviation brought back. The thing is, though, it is always so cost-prohibitively expensive that the margins, the profit margins for supersonic flight are so slim if they exist at all. It's hard. Why supersonic companies fail isn't that they can't figure out how to make sonic booms softer over land, which we are developing right now, which they are working right now. It's how do you make this freaking thing profitable versus a regular airliner? But the biggest thing is that it used to be for the Concorde, you would pay $10,000 per ticket to get from New York to Paris in 3 hours or 2.5 hours, whatever. You want to make a lunch meeting with so-and-so in London in 2.5 hours from New York City. What you can do now, this is what killed it among the profitability issue, is that you can make a Skype call or a Zoom call or a video conference in seconds. You can be in London, you can be in Dubai, you can be in Paris, and vice versa. The internet killed supersonic air travel. And that's just the simple truth of it. Thank you for listening to Geek Therapy Radio. I've got a baby on the way, so yeah, I'm going to pitch. If I can remember in the outros of these shows, if you'd like to sponsor Geek Therapy Radio, help me buy diapers, just reach out to me, geektherapyradio.com, or you can email me, geektherapy@iheartmedia.com. I love to talk to you. If you're a small business owner and you might be thinking, oh, it's too expensive to advertise on the radio, I don't got the budget for it, well, talk to me. We can work something out. Diapers, you know, diapers cost, but I'm not going to take your leg off to sponsor me on Geek Therapy Radio. So reach out to me if you want, geektherapyradio.com. More importantly, know that you, the listener, whoever you are loved and you are worthy of love. Thank you so much for listening to Geek Therapy Radio. Check out the podcast. I'll talk to you next week.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.